From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on September 22nd when Senator Elizabeth Warren rolled out a new plan to address housing in this country. Warren said that housing was supposed to be a place where families can build wealth, but too many Americans are left out of that opportunity. And she traced the divide to decades of racist action and policy in government, in banks, in communities. For example, Warren points out that in many predominantly white communities, first-time homebuyers have the benefit of intergenerational wealth to make a down payment or get started on a mortgage. Due to America's history of redlining and segregation, many young couples of color can't benefit from intergenerational wealth, and Senator Warren proposes to fix that by offering direct assistance. Here's how the Atlantic Monthly described this plan, quote, "The legislation titled the American Housing and Economic Mobility Act is perhaps the most far-reaching assault on housing segregation since the 1968 Fair Housing Act. Ask an economist or any recent graduate trying to afford rent and they'll tell you, America is still in a housing crisis. Senator Warren's plan aims to lower the cost of developing housing so landlords don't have to make rents so high, coming at the issue from two different angles. From one end, it tries to increase the supply of affordable housing by pouring billions of federal dollars into programs that subsidize developments in rural, low-income and middle-income communities, and from the other end, the bill attempts to strip away the zoning laws that made developing housing so expensive in the first place. Many of these zoning laws limit low-income residents from moving to wealthier neighborhoods," end quote. So, can it work? This hour, we discuss one of the most detailed plans yet proposed in this presidential campaign, and we're wondering if housing is an important issue for you when you consider your own financial future and when you consider this presidential campaign. Our guests this hour are here to talk about it. Welcome back to Matthew Denker, developer with Labeled Living, that if you see it on paper, you might say LBLD, like I did the first time I met him. Hello again.
Honored to be back so soon.
I'm glad to correct the record with Labeled Living. Thanks for being here. And Professor Nana Ando is back with us, a professor of architecture at RIT. Welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we want to tell you this hour, this is part of a series of conversations on this program in which you will notice we are less interested in what we call horse race politics, who's up, who's down. I mean, we'll mention polls here and there. I think they can be instructive. But for the most part, we want to talk about what these actual proposals would do in our lives, in our communities, in this country. Whether it's Donald Trump or Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or anybody proposing something specific, you've heard us talk about Andrew Yang's proposal for a universal basic income. We've talked about Senator Warren's proposal regarding student loan forgiveness. And today, it's housing. So you can join the conversation if you like. But before we even start, I thought we ought to listen to what Senator Warren has to say about this issue. Now, she was in Iowa, where all the candidates go, because of the totally inequitable system in which Iowa gets to go first, which is a whole other show. And you can tell in this clip that her voice is just about gone. But here she is responding to a question from an audience member regarding her plan for housing.
New construction in America has moved to the high end. So if you're rich, there's a lot of housing opportunities. But if you're middle class, working poor, or poor, what's basically happened is there hasn't been much new housing coming in. The government has backed out from what it was doing. And the consequence is housing is deteriorating, and at the same time, the price is going up. So what can we do about it? I'll tell you exactly what we can do about it. We can build 3.2 million new housing units across this country. Urban, rural, we can do this. What would be the consequence of doing that? First, is we'd produce about 1.5 million jobs, local jobs, good jobs, that's a good part. Second, we would bring down, according to Moody's, the price of rents, instead of their continuing to go up, by about 10%. That's their estimate. And think about it. You bring 3.2 million new housing units online. It affects prices overall, not just the new units you bring in, because it affects the market. But that's not all we need to do. The number one way that families, working families, middle-class families build wealth is they buy a home. And that's how it's worked generation after generation for white families, but not for African-American and Latino families. But here's the part about money talks. So I go talk to experts in Washington. I put this bill together. I talk about this will be senior housing. This would be housing for people with disabilities. This has so many places, housing in rural areas where it's falling apart. Lots of good stuff that comes out of this. Remember, 3.2 million new housing units, plus all the spillover good effects from this and jobs. And who would help pay for this? The 10,000 richest families in America. And do you know what people in Washington say to me? You can never do that. Because 10,000 rich families have so much more power in Washington than millions of American families who are struggling to pay. So what I say to them is you just wait till 2020.
That is Senator Elizabeth Warren recently in Iowa discussing her housing plan. Now, she talked about how she would pay for it. Again, that the tax on the 10,000 richest families that she talked about there is an estate tax. And an outside study by Moody's Analytics found that raising the estate tax would ensure that the bill would not create a deficit. So at least one analyst, Moody's, says that this can work, that is an effective way to pay for it. And then when it comes to some of the other specifics, let me just read a little bit more from the Atlantic Monthly's analysis, and then I'll turn to our guests for some opening thoughts, because there's a lot of specifics here and a lot of different directions to take this. On the subject to a remedy of a history of racism, I'm going to quote the Atlantic Monthly. The bill focuses on the ways housing inequality falls along racial lines. Notably, it assists populations that federal housing policy has historically failed. Formerly segregated African-American populations and families whose housing wealth was destroyed in the financial crisis. Under the bill, black families long denied mortgages by the federal government qualify for down payment assistance, helping many in formerly segregated communities become first-time homebuyers. The bill invests $2 billion to support borrowers still recovering from the financial crisis who have negative equity on their mortgages, in other words, underwater. So that is a direct response to that. And have we remedied segregation already? Well, Marissa Baradarin is an author of The Color of Money, Black Banks and the Racial Wealth Gap, and helped advise Senator Warren on this bill. And here is what Baradarin told The Atlantic Monthly, quote, "We have stopped actively segregating, but these segregation patterns in this country have stayed that way and really have been self-perpetuating on their own because of policy," end quote. She believes that Senator Warren's bill goes a long way to remedy the federal government's pattern of under-investigating in minority populations. She particularly appreciates the bill's focus on the subprime mortgage crisis because, in her mind, that is intertwined with the legacy of segregation. Communities with a history of segregation were especially vulnerable to subprime mortgages and were targeted by lenders and banks. Braderin says, quote, "These formerly redlined areas were the prime market for those loans, those subprime loans. And in the financial crisis, America's black population lost more than 53% of its wealth because of housing foreclosures. That wealth has not been recovered yet," end quote. So there's a lot there. I'm going to ask both of you for some opening thoughts, and I'll start with Matt Denker. What do you think, Matt?
Wow, this is very broad. So I think the bill does a couple of separate things. One, it does targeted assistance for underserved communities, previously segregated. And I think in that case, it's incredibly good, although I do worry, because I looked into it, the assistance isn't necessarily to stay in that community. So anyone who can afford it can basically take the down payment assistance and move to somewhere else, which I wouldn't want to stop anyone from doing. I think that's great. But the policy level locally is going to have to do something to make sure more neighborhoods don't drain out from that happening, that the money doesn't come and everyone moves to a better neighborhood. And there's still some...
And you're using air quote, a quote-unquote better neighborhood.
Yes, right. Exactly. And then as far as spending new money on housing, I think that's the other big thing. 3 million units sounds like a lot. It is quite a few. It's got to be about 1% of the units currently existing in the country that we live in, probably a little less than that. Just to think about it in the case of, say, the city of Rochester... is a good way to think about things. There are 90,000 units of housing in the city of Rochester. And so if we increase that by 3%, we're looking at building, about 2,700 units. That would be roughly nine times the amount of buildings being put where the Inner Loop used to be.
Is that – so 2,700 buildings?
2,700 units.
2,700 units. What kind of impact do you think that could have in the Rochester community?
I mean, I'm not sure we have the construction workers to make those units happen. I mean, it could have a transformational impact. We're not seeing units added at that kind of rate in Monroe County to begin with, let alone here.
So let me follow up by asking you, and I'll ask both of you this question. So far, understanding that policies change and evolve given conditions and demands politically, et cetera, from what we've seen so far, the biggest strength of this proposal is what?
I think the way it helps previously segregated communities, I think that's a really big deal.
Okay. And the biggest weakness?
That it's probably not large enough. As crazy as that sounds, it's not large enough.
So you're saying it could have a transformational effect in Rochester as a community, but nationally?
I don't think 1% is enough to fix the problem. You know, that 30% of the population still rents. And I think renting needs to be a more acceptable thing to do. But moving that needle 1% doesn't really change that 30% rental tenure.
Okay. Professor Ando, how do you see the bill broadly speaking?
I see this as a very positive thing, primarily because it is addressing housing inequality and also access to home ownership and wealth building. And I think the political will to be able to do that is absolutely tremendous on her part. And I think we ought to be looking at this in its aspirational goals as opposed to what might be making it an impossibility, if you will.
Making it an impossibility politically right now?
Politically, correct.
Yeah, I mean, that's why in the clip she concludes by saying wait till 2020, because I think that is a tacit admission that, yes, Democrats won the House. They don't have the Senate. There's no chance without essentially Democrats across the board that you're going to see a proposal to tax the 10,000 richest families in this way pass. And she's admitting that. But you're saying, set aside the politics right now, she's at least laying out aspirations and there's value there?
Exactly. Because unfortunately, we live in a country right now where you live determines your future outcomes. Meaning, if I live in a specific neighborhood, I am tied to that school. And depending on the education I get in that school, that could lead to whatever job I can get. So if I can have more housing options, I have better opportunities. And if this bill is investing money into my community, I can have better schools, better roads, better police force, and everything else that everyone else has. And that increases my chances of becoming more successful.
What is the biggest strength that you see in this proposal?
I see the biggest strength as the money being invested and the units being built, because in my mind, that also provides jobs. And I think what we see as a weakness being that it is not enough, to me, I still see as a strength because I see that as a starting point.
Okay. And do you see a biggest weakness in this proposal so far?
I think the unintended consequences was brought up, that being given money for a down payment for a house but the option to purchase that anywhere you want can be an unintended consequence where you might get neighborhoods that get depleted. So maybe more of an incentive to stay in a neighborhood and an investment in a neighborhood to improve it might be a better option.
Okay. Listeners, I want to hear from you this hour. How important is housing as an issue for you? You know, it's interesting. We have talked about the real estate market. If you are looking to buy a home that is somewhere north of six figures, it's very difficult. I mean, the market is a seller's market right now across our suburbs, across the quote-unquote hotter neighborhoods in Rochester. Sellers are getting more than they're even asking. They're getting multiple bids. People are waiving inspections. But if you are a first-time home buyer, if you are someone who's come from communities that are more impoverished, if you are trying to build up communities that have been dealing with a lot of poverty, it's a very different story. And I think that Senator Warren is trying to distinguish between a little bit of that dividing line in this country. So where is housing for you personally? What help do you think that that home buyers and young families, young professionals, young Americans could use? 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Now, before the program, Matt, you kind of outlined a little bit of your concern as well about not just, I think mobility, but how this may end up being a little bit zero sum. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. So if we look at housing as a thing that exists right now and not consider building new just for a second, you know, people own it and they've been considering it to be an investment for better or worse. And it's no judgment on that. But if there are people who don't own it and they would like to, and we want to make it more affordable for them. There's no clear way to do that without reducing the investment of the people who already own it. I mean, the solution is going to be building more, but I can tell you that building new houses is more expensive than houses that already exist. You know, new housing is more expensive. It's the top of the market for any number of reasons. I mean, everything from, say, land acquisition and zoning, which this tries to address, and we can talk about a little later. But just, I mean, when was the last time you bought a house that didn't have air conditioning? So it's sort of like a car. Cars have airbags now. They are more expensive now than they used to be in the past. That's not to say we shouldn't have airbags. It's a safety feature. It's very important. Houses now all have significant fire safety to them that they didn't used to have, and that's very valuable, but that does cost something. And none of those requirements have been subsidized along the way. So the housing has gotten more expensive with no way for people to afford that, and they've fallen off the bottom end, I mean, which is what this is trying to address.
But why is this a problem? A problem may be the wrong word, but why does it have to be zero sum? In other words, for the people who own housing and have been able to build wealth through equity in houses, why are they going to lose some if others who haven't been able to own housing are able to finally gain?
If we just had houses sitting around, we could just hand out to people who don't have houses. It wouldn't be an issue. But if, say, you bought your house for $100,000 and someone else can only afford a house that's $80,000, we build a house somehow that's $80,000 and then they buy it. At the end of the day, if there was an $80,000 house, the question is, why is the $100,000 house still worth $100,000? How does the market not end up at $90,000 each, all else being equal? And so, you know, it's sort of like, if the price of eggs goes up because there's more demand for it, at some point someone's going to make more of it. It's similar to oil. When oil was very expensive, we found a whole bunch of new oil to drill for,
and the price will come down. Supply and demand.
Yeah.
And I'm a little embarrassed that I needed a refresher on the lesson. But this is really, it goes back to that basic lesson of supply and demand. So it could reduce assessed values for those who currently are homeowners, yes?
Or more importantly, the value of their home won't increase as fast as they were expecting it to. It's not to say that their house is suddenly going to be worth $99,000 instead of $100,000. I think you could keep building houses. But if they were expecting to be able to retire to Florida and sell a house for $200,000 that had been worth $100,000 10 years later, using a basic rule of seven, but all of a sudden it's only worth $110,000, it's not the wealth building that they were expecting it to be, right? I mean, it's worth less at the end of it based on inflation alone.
Even if Senator Warren would agree with this analysis, I don't know that she would or wouldn't, is this a necessary or a worthy trade-off to remedy a problem that is this ingrained in this country?
For equity, absolutely. Yes.
So you're saying it's not a perfect solution, but you don't see a perfect solution.
No, I don't think there is. I don't think everyone can win as much on housing as they want to. I mean, part of the way that wealth, for better or worse, part of the way that wealth was built by these white families was, in fact, by extracting it from the black families who weren't getting housing at the time. And so to give that back, it has to come from somewhere.
Okay. Do you think, Professor Ondo, that history in this country, is this a time for us to refresh on the history? And I ask that because I've said on this program, I had never heard the term redlining until I was maybe almost 30 years old. Certainly never in my public school education days. And I doubt in college. So whether it was Ta-Nehisi Coates' work or the work of others to really kind of talk about economic dispossession, and I know that's being taught in more classrooms, but it's not necessarily universal. Is this a moment with this proposal to say, hey, the reason we need this proposal is this history that not all of us are being taught?
I could not agree more. In the Master of Architecture program at RIT, I teach a course on urban and regional planning. And we start with the idea of policy, because policy dictates how we build, and how we build affects how we live. So if we go back to 1926, there was a landmark case of the town of Euclid and Ambler Rib Realty in Ohio that determined our zoning laws. That very same year, there was another case, I believe it was Corrigan and Buckley, and that was all about redlining. It dictated that if a group of white people owned a piece of land, they could determine not to sell that to a black person. And the Supreme Court upheld that. So that essentially made it legal, if you will, to exclude a group of people from owning property in specific areas. So if we look at the data now, for instance, in Rochester, I can take a look at reading levels in high schools, high school graduation rates, the number of kids who go to college, college graduation rates, home ownership, income, and overlay that on a map of how Rochester was redlined, and the numbers are going to be outstanding simply because it matches up, right? That if you were put in a specific geographic location in Rochester, your outcome was almost predetermined. So this is really a time when we want to go back and take a look at neighborhoods that we've taken things from and see how this bill can start to give things back to those neighborhoods.
Yeah, those official legal policies were codified. And I know that a lot of people may be saying, well, you can't do that today, right? Well, maybe not as overtly, but again, the author that I cited at the outset and others have said that we're nowhere near a place of real equity. And the bill that Elizabeth Warren proposes restructures the Community Reinvestment Act, which is a 1977 law proposed to monitor banks with discriminatory loan policies against communities of color. So Senator Warren is saying we should not be satisfied with where we are. Do you agree with that, Professor?
I absolutely agree, because when I was living in Brooklyn maybe 15, 20 years ago, we would call for pizza delivery and they would ask where you live and they can tell you, I don't deliver to that address, simply because it's been gerrymandered as so, right? That neighborhood is too dangerous, or there are too many black people there, so it's too dangerous for us to go there. If you were to go for a bank loan, again, it might be a high interest, or it might be that this house might not be for you. We have something in a different place that you might be more comfortable in. So there are certainly hidden intrinsic ways in which redlining is illegal, but was still being reinforced. Mm-hmm. So that is something that this bill is really trying to rectify, which is why I think this bill is very comprehensive in what it is trying to do, and maybe overly so. But again, the political will to be able to propose it is what I really applaud.
All right, let me start with a phone call. Carlene in Rochester wants to start. Go ahead, Carlene.
Yes, back in the, I think it was the late 70s, early 80s, they had a program called 312 Money, and that was primarily in the Southeast, where is now South Wedge and that whole area. And you could buy a property that needed a lot of work and at the same time get a matching loan to fix it up at 3.5%. So there were a lot of young people and people that knew carpentry or various trades, and they bought into houses for $8,000, $10,000, $20,000 that are substantial 1920s homes, and restored those houses and were able to pay them back at a regular rate because they bought them low but put their sweat equity into the properties. That program was so successful is one of the reasons why you have the South Wedge and the whole area totally revitalized in this section of the city. If they brought back a program like that and also had programs in the high schools to train young people in some of the trades, carpentry, plumbing, they don't get enough people into those programs, or are they able to be accessed in a night school program where people could actually obtain a house and do the work? But the work must be guaranteed to be done. In other words, if you're getting $20,000-$25,000 for, you know, heating, plumbing, etc., you have inspectors that come through and make sure you do the work. So that kind of a program helps people who are middle class, lower middle class, access and poor, access properties. People bought houses, beautiful houses, for $10,000 that nobody else would live in because they had been appeared to be at their usefulness end, and it wasn't true. So what they have to stop thinking about is entirely brand new construction and quality reconstruction. There were some companies that were formed, companies that were headed by minorities. Some did good, some were not as successful. but you need, there are trained professionals that you can have and bring into the community, and at the same time be giving young people an education and a trade for life. Anyhow, that's what I have to say about it.
Carlene, thank you. I appreciate that. And you know, she's looking at specific neighborhoods and parts of our own community. You know, Matt Denker said earlier this hour, the one kind of the early concern you have in looking at this kind of a proposal from Senator Warren is what might happen to communities when you increase mobility and you kind of allow people to have a much more actual freedom of movement. I want to go back to what the Atlantic Monthly said. Let's touch on this point now, too, because I think this is important. Quote, from the other end of Senator Warren's policy, the bill attempts to strip away the zoning laws that made developing housing so expensive in the first place. Many of these zoning laws limit low-income residents from moving to wealthier neighborhoods. End quote. And you said that is important, but if it's quote unquote a wealthier neighborhood or what, you know, population better neighborhood, whatever the case may be, and I'm not all that comfortable with that terminology, but I think everybody agrees on that. Matt, what can be done for communities where people are moving out of?
So what to the remaining community there? That's tough. I think it depends on how many people leave. I mean, are we talking like Centralia, Pennsylvania, where
I don't know.
Everyone's gone?
This is similar to me. This is sort of a similar question that we have when we talk charter schools. That if you have quote unquote struggling schools or districts or neighborhood schools, and then you take a non-zero percentage of children with really sort of attuned families, and they move out and they send them to charter schools. What are you doing for the school that is? It's sort of a similar question for me.
So I hate to broaden the topic of this even more than this housing already, but I think from an environmental perspective, if we could get everyone from Pittsford to move into the city of Rochester rather than everyone left in the city of Rochester to move to Pittsford, we'd be better off. That from an infrastructure perspective, that it would be better if we could densify into what exists than get the last of the people out from places that aren't. So from that perspective, I think it'd be better if we were investing in people moving into neighborhoods that were not previously well-loved. And not to displace people, that's not the idea here, but to actually make neighborhoods more inclusive that exist than trying to drain out the segregated neighborhoods that exist.
And you do that, again, by adding density?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so that's one idea there. Are you concerned, Professor, about neighborhoods that might be left behind if families gain more mobility and decide to, quote-unquote, move out?
I don't necessarily see that as an either-or. And using the example of Pittsford and downtown, I think what this bill is trying to do is it is almost trying to say we're going to incentivize Pittsford to allow for more affordable housing. And in that sense, if I live downtown and I know Pittsford being a great area, I am maybe ideally going to move to Pittsford. And I think what this bill ought to do is also include a provision where what makes you want to move to Pittsford? And can we bring some of those amenities downtown to make it better or equitable to want to remain downtown? And then the money that we give you, you can then choose either stay downtown Rochester or move to Pittsford, and that those decisions should not be mutually exclusive.
Okay. You want to add to that, Matt?
No, I tend to agree. I mean, the exact mechanism that the bill is using is it's trying to incentivize changes to zoning to allow for more affordable and more inclusive housing to be built. There's kind of a real laundry list of things that communities can change to qualify to get that incentive money. The incentive money is to be used for infrastructure and schools and libraries and things like that. Because at the end of the day, it's not very American to, from the top, tell everyone, no, you can't do that anymore, kind of from a zoning perspective. And also zoning is local in this country, and so it's different everywhere. To a degree, I think that will work some, but I'm also not entirely sure that the communities that have the kind of snob zoning that exists now are necessarily going
is
to change it.
Is that an official term?
It is. It's not a judgment of any of the communities that have it. It's just what it's called. I don't know that they're going to take the bait on changing that to have more affordable housing in their communities.
All right. And before we go to break, I want to ask Professor Ondo one more point on the subject of intergenerational wealth, because Senator Warren is saying one of the reasons we need this is because we have a huge divide in this country among those who come from families with intergenerational wealth and those who don't. And you can look at a map and guess pretty accurately, as you've sort of indicated. A lot of zip code really is destiny. It comes from redlining. It comes from our own history of policies and how we constructed these communities and who we sort of pushed to live where. This is a quote from MSNBC when Mitt Romney was speaking to Otterbein University and students about the ways that he wanted to see people decide. He wanted more Americans to be willing to take a risk, to go get an education, to start a business, to buy your own home. He said, quote, "We've always encouraged young people, take a shot, go for it, take a risk, get that education, borrow money if you have to from your parents, start a business." Mitt Romney talking to students at Otterbein, which is a nice thought if that were roughly the case for most or all Americans. I'm not at all casting aspersions at Governor Romney for the notion that it would be nice to be able to ask your family. I'm wondering if that's what you think everyone can do if you're a little bit bubbled. And I think Senator Warren is trying to flip that and say, that is not the reality for a lot of Americans. You can't even get a down payment on a house. There is no intergenerational wealth. We did that. We have to fix it. Is that a fair way to frame that?
Absolutely. And if I recall, he said, borrow $10,000 from your family or something like
yeah.
that. And
he put a very specific number on it. It was
right.
not a small number. Yeah.
And I looked over at my dad and we both laughed because we don't have $10,000 in our account. So there's no way I'm borrowing that from my father. So I think that kind of thinking, yes, it's great, but it absolutely is unrealistic for most people who live in these neighborhoods. And what this bill is trying to do is say, we've put in, or there've existed systematic ways in which you now live in the current conditions that you live in now, and we're going to try to put in financial mechanisms to help you get out of it. And that is what this bill is really trying to address.
All right, we're talking about the policy proposal set from Senator Elizabeth Warren, who of course is running for president, but her proposal came out in September and she's been tweaking it. It is among the most specific and broad-reaching attempts to address housing inequality in this country, and the Atlantic Monthly saying it's the most far-reaching and ambitious assault on housing segregation since 1968. So, by the way, to Professor Ondo's point, Mitt Romney had told the story of a friend of his who borrowed $20,000 back in 1983. So you remember it as $10,000.
Yeah.
He was talking about, well, just borrowed $20,000 from your family. It's an interesting conversation about policy, specific policy, how it would impact our communities, how it would impact a lot of very specific issues that are left with all of this. We're going to get back to your phone calls in just a moment. We're going to take our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back and continue the conversation with Professor Nana Ondo from RIT and Matthew Denker, a developer with Labeled Living. Let's go ahead and take that only break and come back to your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, the Genesee River Watch is out with their first ever report cards for the Genesee River in the River Basin. And the answer is, well, it only got a C. Water quality is a problem. What is doing most of the polluting in the Genesee River and the tributaries? Well, we're going to discuss it next hour. We're going to understand why the grade was so low and what we can do about it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get back to your feedback. This is Richard in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Richard.
Hi. You know, Rochester has a history of using wonderful government programs to stabilize neighborhoods and enable minorities to pay a reasonable rent so they could save to own. The 312 program is not the only route. In the South Wedge, South Wedge is referred to by a prior caller, I was able to utilize a wonderful HUD program called Mod Rehab. I obtained a loan from HUD for $15,000 per unit, where only moderate rehab was needed. In exchange, I agreed to rent to families where they would pay only 30% of their income towards rent. The government paid me the balance. After 15 years, the loan I took from HUD was paid off, and the tenants continued to have Section 8 certificates, which they could use to remain in place or move anywhere else in the city. The program was used to update an entire garden apartment project, and for 2, 3, and 4 family units in all neighborhoods. What a difference that would make today. Does the developer on the program think that would be viable if it were renewed?
Matt?
That's a great question. I mean, I think to some degree, that's kind of the sort of program that this is trying to do. I know we talk about 3 million new units of housing, but in fact, I think it's kind of a mix of rehabbing existing housing and new housing and to try and keep it affordable. If you look at the actual numbers, the bill proposes to spend $300,000 a unit for that combination of building and rehab. You almost have to. I mean, one of the problems right now is what if you don't let abate an old house when you go to do it? Who does that fall on? What happens then? I think there are real issues with expectations for safety in housing in 2019 that maybe are more prescient now than they've ever been before. And partially for the same reason. I mean, if you weren't taking care of that, I mean, there's a reason that parts of Rochester that were redlined are also lined up with the high lead concern areas and that we need to take care of it. It's because someone does need to be looking out for this kind of thing.
If zombie homes could be taken by the city promptly enough before they get vandalized, the $15,000 budget in today's terms, it would be twice that amount, could really make a tremendous difference with a large number of houses.
Agree or disagree there?
I mean, I it's not nothing. It would absolutely make some kind of difference. But I mean, if you had an old house, you're going to spend $15,000 to $30,000 just lead and asbestos abating it properly. It's really challenging to not spend that kind of money to do it. And it's also, that's not the kind of thing that you're going to be able to teach a high schooler to do in the trades either. I mean, it's like a really tough problem to wrap around.
Professor, I want to read an email from a listener named Angela who says, I'm sorry, but when would we stop? Who gets help for housing and who doesn't? This seems like a recipe for unfairness. What would you say to Angela?
I think that thought process can lead you down a dangerous road a little bit simply because if, quote unquote, a wealthy person or a middle class person wants to buy a house, there are mechanisms for them to be able to afford it and buy it. But when it comes to talking about low-income families, we talk about special programs and rehab facilities and different kinds of mechanisms in which they should have to go through to be able to afford a house. And I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to level the playing field. And somehow everyone sees that as a slippery slope, right? That where will that stop? And that should not be our way of thinking. We should be thinking of how can we make everything as equitable? Because we have a segment of people in this country who have for years worked as free labor. And when they became free, nothing was given to them. And they're being told to essentially pick themselves up from their bootstraps and they don't have any boots. So now that we're trying to actually give them boots, people are complaining that at what point will they stop asking for boots and ask for pants? You know, that at some point, we just need to make this conversation as equitable as possible, saying, what can we do to help everyone, as opposed to this being a slippery slope?
Yeah, I mean, for me, Angela, I think that's really a great analogy. Another analogy that comes to mind for me, Angela, is, and I'm very sensitive about using this analogy because I know cancer is a sensitive subject, but right now, there's no real way to treat cancer without doing some damage to the body on healthy cells. I mean, what doctors are trying to do is they're trying to remove the damaged or cancerous cells. And eventually the gold standard will be some kind of a treatment where you can only remove the cancerous cells. Maybe it's nanotech, I don't know. I mean, the future is going to be an amazing place if we can keep the planet habitable. But if you agree that there is a cancer, if you agree that there is a problem, and you agree that you're going to treat it somehow, you know, think about the treatments there are. You're trying to destroy or end or stop the spread of cancer, and yes, you're going to damage other tissue. There's going to be some deleterious impact. There's going to be some unintended consequences. When you have something as complicated as housing inequality and structural racism that goes back decades, I doubt a single policy fixes all of that and doesn't impact anybody who wouldn't have any sort of an unfair impact. And if the standard is wait till you have something perfect, I think you're stuck. I just don't see anything that is going to propose that. So the question is, do we agree there's a problem that needs to be remedied in some way? And then, is this a step toward it? Is this the best policy for it? I do think, Matthew Denker, I'll ask both of you this. Regardless of what ends up taking shape in terms of policy. These conversations move us in a direction because, look, we're not sitting here saying Democrats good, Republicans bad, Republicans good, Democrats bad. That's a waste of time. We're actually looking at specific proposals and saying, forget about what you think about Elizabeth Warren. Here's where our guests think this policy really works. Here's where they think it might have problems. Here's where they think the underlying philosophy. That's valuable. Forget the D's and the R's and the political parties. I think we're finally having substantive discussion on policy that's probably been lacking in this area. Are you an optimist that we're going to go in that direction?
I think so. I mean, if there's one great change that's coming out of all of this, it's I hope this awareness of housing as, say, a percentage of your income makes a difference, because that's, I think that addresses a lot of this idea of fairness too, right? If everyone is expected to contribute 30% of their income towards their housing, and if they want to spend more, they can, but contribute 30%, I think that goes a long way towards addressing that, you know, to, you know, that you're making X and you're providing 30% of X, and that's what you can handle. I mean, for so long, all of our subsidies have been in terms of, say, dollars. You know, you're going to get $200 in food stamps a month or whatever that number is. And to actually think of it as percentage based, I think makes a huge difference. And just moving the conversation in that direction is worthwhile.
Okay. You're more of an optimist that we're having a substance, not just here, but elsewhere, that this country is going to have this conversation?
Absolutely, I am. And I think this kind of conversation can only help that we realize there is a problem that needs fixing. And regardless of whatever side of the aisle you're on, that you want to come up with a policy that addresses these kinds of issues.
So I also have an email from a listener named Sarah who basically said, I'm never going to own a house. How about that? I've already given up. I'm in my late 20s. There's a significant number of Americans. What does that say, Professor Ondo, about policy that you've got Americans like Sarah saying, that's it, like I'm nearing 30, and in my mind, I will never own a house in this country?
Well, I guess I'd be curious if it's given up or if it's it feels like a futile attempt at being able to own a house. And I would say that with programs like this, there is always hope, and that if a program like this comes to fruition and if there is government assistance, that there's always a way to be able to kind of start that ideal towards being able to own a home. And I'd really encourage people to think about home ownership not as an end, that I'm looking for that home that I'm going to die in, right? But I'm looking for the home I'm going to start in and build that wealth. So that home does not need to be your 3,000-4,000 square foot McMansion, but it can be a small 500 square foot tiny house or something, right? That I can start small and build up, and that I don't need to pay, you know, 300,000-400,000 to buy my first house. That my first house can be a little bit smaller, if you will.
Okay, Matt.
I mean, this one's tough. I would advise anyone never to be hopeless about being able to buy a home. I mean, there's. Home, it's like there's more fish in the sea. There's more homes out there. You know, there is one for you that can be made to work, I guess. But on the other hand, I worry sometimes that we put too much weight on home ownership. I mean, it as wealth building is what this is trying to do is very valuable. I don't want to discourage that. But I also feel as though we frequently treat the renters as an underclass, and mm-hmm. There's no reason for that. I mean, if you own a home, and this is the thing I was discussing with somebody the other day. A lot of Americans, I think the number is 40% of Americans don't have $400 in savings for like an emergency repair, say, to their car. Right. What happens when the water heater dies and you own a house? I mean, if there's an advantage to renting, it's not your problem. Your rent is covering that. That's the whole idea. If you own a home, that you own that too. And I don't know if we have a solution for helping all the way through with that kind of problem. Because if you own a home, it's the only hot water you have is yours. And if you don't have $400 to fix your water heater, you don't have hot water at the end of the day.
So on the subject of renting that you bring up, Senator Warren's plan seeks to address that as well. And again, I'll go back to the article I've been citing from the Atlantic Monthly, which is this. Warren's plan aims to lower the cost of developing housing so landlords don't have to make rents so high. Can that happen? I mean, do you find a path for that?
Absolutely. I mean, we don't need to look any further than Buffalo just to see, say you get rid of parking minimums. Just to build a new house in Rochester, if you're going to build a driveway, it's $6,000 to $10,000. If you're building a $200,000 house, that's 5% of the budget right there. I mean, that makes a meaningful difference. That driveway alone is already 1 to 2% of the rent on it. And there's a whole number of things like that. And those are the kinds of things that the bill tries to push to reduce parking minimums, to increase density in zoning. to reduce minimum lot sizes, things like that. And so I do think there's a way forward for that also, for reducing the cost of new housing without necessarily, say, compromising safety.
Okay. I want to read a comment from a listener named Terry. Let me pull it back. It says, Evan, great conversation that's ignoring one important factor, white flight. I'm a white guy. I can tell you, white people are very good at fleeing what they don't like. That's how we got the suburbs. Don't underestimate white people's capacity to flee again if you allow for more social mobility. That's from Terry. Let's start with Matt on that.
It could absolutely happen, I guess. I mean, at some point you're limited by your ability to get transportation back to wherever you're job was and jobs are. But I mean, we see that in a lot of places in the country, that whole, say, drive to afford it, that if you need to go no further than the exurbs of Houston or Denver to see. I can't believe that people commute into the city from Canandaigua sometimes, but people drive twice that far every day in Denver just to get to work. They drive 60 miles each way instead of 30. So, I mean, yes, that could absolutely happen. But I think a rising tide lifts all boats, and that's what we should be targeting.
What do you think, Professor?
I would just be curious as to exactly what it is that you are fleeing from. Are you fleeing from poor people or black people or both? And why do you feel the need to flee from them? And what I see happening now is, if bills like this and conversations like this begin to happen, and we're trying to make the playing field equitable wherever you flee to, you're going to find the people that you're fleeing from there as well.
So as we get ready to wrap this conversation, Terry, thanks for the email. Let's get ready to wrap this conversation. A few minutes left here. Tell me, Matt, if you were in the room with Senator Warren and you joined her policy team to at least try to shape things, and she says to you, I don't want your endorsement. I don't want your rah-rah. I want your criticism, and I want to know how to make this better. And you're going to have that conversation with her. Where are you starting? What are you going to do?
So not only should there be more money, I hate to get so specific, but we're towards the end of the show. There was one thing I read in here that I worry about a little bit. I didn't get to read the whole bill word for word, but I read through the first section anyway. And the first thing in the zoning section is that to get the money for incentives, one of the things a community can do is allow by right zoning. But unfortunately, that's how zoning in the U.S. works. Because of the way zoning exists as the police powers of state, everywhere has by right zoning already. If you have zoning, there are things you are allowed to build in a place. Whether it's something that you'd want to see or not isn't a thing. But we're not like the UK, where it's discretionary zoning. And so I worry that there's not enough focus on that part of it to actually make the difference.
Okay. What would you say, Professor?
This might be a little bit idealistic that the entire country can essentially be the same, but I would highly encourage her to think about incentivizing wealthier neighborhoods to bring in affordable housing. How can we make lower income neighborhoods more attractive so that instead of people wanting to leave, that they're more incentivized to stay?
In our last couple of minutes, we have had a couple of comments. I would say maybe in the same vein, when Matt Denker said earlier this hour, you know, we shouldn't just create like an underclass of renters. I think the point was well taken. I have some emailers saying a kind of a different flavor of that. Didn't we get the housing crisis because we wanted an ownership society? Everyone should own a home, make it easy. And then the banks, well, it was much more complex than that. I mean, the banks created really nefarious documents, and by chopping up subprime mortgages and yes, signing up mortgages for just about anybody who asked for them. So it was a layered issue. But some of our listeners are saying, why do we have to always push for ownership here? You know, what's wrong with that? I think that splits the difference a little. I think what Matt's saying is don't create this, don't just make it a pejorative to say you're a renter. But I also hear Professor Ondo saying, you know, this has been wealth creation that's been denied to a lot of people. And so what would you say to our emailers, Professor, who say, well, why are we obsessed with owning? Didn't that get us in trouble a decade ago?
Well, I would say that ownership gives you credit worthiness, if you will. Okay, that we live in a country where if you go buy a car or if you want a credit card, it's based on your credit. And depending on how much you own, that becomes your collateral. So you have, low-income people with high-interest credit rates on everything. And by simply having that ownership of a home, that could bring that down by a bunch of points, where now, instead of having a credit card with 25% interest, it comes down to 9% or 5%. So everything is cumulative, and that is what we want to think about, is how do we actually build wealth? We build wealth by being able to save. And you cannot save if you have to spend everything on fees and on high interest rates.
Okay. 20 seconds. You agree with that? Is that fair? Does that split the difference?
Very much so. Yes. I value homeownership. It's worthwhile. I mean, people should do it, but I also don't think we should think less of renters.
I'm with you on that. I want to thank our guests for a really stimulating conversation about a very detailed set of policy proposals regarding housing in this country from Senator Elizabeth Warren. Matthew Denker is a developer with Labeled Living. That's LBLD Living. Labeled Living is how you pronounce it. It's great to have you back here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Professor Nana Ando, professor of architecture at RIT, for your expertise and time as well. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
A short break and more connections coming up.